So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Ryuve!
Undertaker is like standing over fallen prey. The wounded Austin. It may be just moments away now from the rattlesnake going down at the hands of the Phenom. Undertaker back on top. This didn't work earlier.
Hello and welcome to Review Away. It is John Pollock and Wei Ting with you. This is show number 2 from Winnipeg, Manitoba. And Wei, are you sick of me yet this week?
No. Of course not. Why would I be?
Well, it's only our second show here. We still have many, many days to go here.
Yeah.
But after 2 days here, what are your general impressions here of Winnipeg? I went in with so many people telling me, oh, Winnipeg. I've been beyond surprised by how clean the city is. Very nice. Everything's in walking distance from our hotel. I've become a big fan of Winnipeg. I might not go home.
Wow. Okay.
Might stay here.
Well, I mean, we haven't really seen too much of it.
I went and walked around, and I found the second cup.
Okay.
And
wow.
I saw the other side of the MTS Center.
Right.
Yeah.
So, right. So you've seen all four sides.
I walked around for about 10 minutes.
You did?
I think okay. I covered the majority of the city.
I'm with you. I think it's really nice here. I mean, it's a beautiful day outside, too. That helps. But everything looks pretty cool. And I went to a nice comic shop downtown. So, yeah.
Didn't buy any, though.
No.
It was quite the comic shop there. Got to see some of a... It was weird seeing these hard copies of Superior Spider-Man. I've only ever seen the digital copies,
right,
and seeing these things in actual physical form.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah. They exist in real life, not just digitally.
There was this really cool book that I saw there. It's Batman and Superman's Children teaming up.
Yeah, that was weird.
How is this even doable, like with Marvel and DC?
No, like, they're both DC.
Oh, are they both DC?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so confused with all this stuff and how it works.
Not that cool anymore?
No, not at all. Well, isn't Fantastic Four is Marvel, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And what are the Avengers?
Marvel.
And Spider-Man's DC?
No.
Isn't that... Oh, shit, Superman... I'm thinking Superman and... Never mind. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
I was confusing Spider-Man with Superman.
Superman. Well, they have the same colors, almost.
Yeah, it's like, how can you tell them apart?
Yeah. But they have done crossovers many times. Like, they've done, like, Superman...
Marvel-DC crossovers.
Yeah.
Well, that's smart to do.
Yeah, they've done Superman-Spider-Man. They did a whole, like, Marvel versus DC thing in the 90s.
Oh, yeah? And how do... Have you read any of those?
I did, yeah.
How did they turn out? Are they kind of...
They had fan voting. So, like, I mean, imagine WWF versus WCW.
Yeah, that's the exact comparison I was going to make.
And, you know, instead of having bookers decide the outcome, they had fans vote. And, of course, it became a popularity contest, right? And so, you know, I think a common opinion you'll find amongst comic readers is that, I mean, perhaps DC has the two strongest characters in comics, or at least two of the very strongest in Batman and Superman, but Marvel has a wider array of popular characters, and so Marvel won 3-2 in the end. But it didn't really matter, because what they did actually was, instead of having like an actual outcome, they had all the characters merge together. And so, you know, at the end of the fights, they had it kind of birthed...
But they all hugged?
No. I mean, it kind of created a new universe, and then all of a sudden, like, you had, like, this thing called Dark Claw, which is like a merger of Batman and Wolverine, Spider-Boy, which is a merger of, Spider-Man and Superboy, and, Super Soldier, which was Captain America and Superman, like, merged together. And they called this the Amalgam Universe. So they did this for, like, a month.
Wow.
It was really cool, actually.
This was in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
So when you watched the Invasion angle, did you have, like, all these ideas from reading comics where this has kind of been done before?
Absolutely. I'm sure every wrestling fan did, right? You know? Like, ideally, you wanted every... I don't know. You wanted the forms of all the characters that you've always wanted, but I mean, we didn't get WCW in it. And
they could have merged
truest form. Yeah, we could.
Diamond Dallas, Taker, Stone Cold, Steve, Helms.
You would have merged those two.
Yeah, I don't know. They didn't do any of that.
Shane Helms and Steve Austin.
Well, kind
of, that's what they had available, right?
Yeah. Well, in a weird way, it was like Shane Helms came in and he was offset by Shane McMahon and thus became Gregory Helms.
Right, right.
And then the Hurricane. Yeah.
Okay.
The Invasion.
Yeah.
They should really put out, WWE should put out a DVD covering the Invasion and like openly addressing how shitty it was. I think a lot of people would buy that. And then you could get like how we would have done it now.
I suppose, yeah.
Get Heyman in there.
I
would love a retrospective of that horrible summer.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I want to relive through that.
I would love to.
We, in a way, we have. Like, we reviewed a lot of those shows. We actually should still continue.
Yeah, we kind of just stopped at one point, but we still have lots to go in that that whole Invasion. We had Buff Bagwell on the show, one of the just random that I asked him, and he got back to me right away and was happy to come on and chat about the Tacoma Dome debacle with Booker T. And yeah.
We should pick that up at some point.
All right. Well, we will definitely do that. We are going back not to the summer of 2001 today, but instead the summer of 1998, The Highway to Hell, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but this was the most purchased SummerSlam in history.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep, this was...
To this day.
Yeah. This did 700,000 buys on pay-per-view, which is astonishing. This did... Because you didn't have all the international markets either. So this show in 98 did more buys domestically than WrestleMania did this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's nuts.
Wow. Yeah, that is amazing. I mean, this was 98, though, which was hottest period of the company, would you say?
This was, it was really that spring of 98 that they just, they overtook Nitro, and they were just on fire at this point on their highway to hell.
Yep.
A lot of fire, a lot of hotness going on in this company at the time. I imagine because of their huge popularity, you were not watching at this point?
I was not, no, I wasn't. We actually almost ended up on the highway to hell at the end of our Niagara Falls.
Oh, man, how did we forget to talk about that on Monday?
I don't know.
Oh, we need to tell this story away because we saved it and we purposely said we got to remember this. I knew two nights ago, that we forgot to talk about something. I knew it was something and that was it.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that? This was, moments, this was like top, maybe even three scariest moments of my life, I think. Honestly, dude.
It's pretty bad.
For you, it'd be even worse. Like, I would not have wanted to drive after that, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty scary. Why don't you tell the people what happened?
Well, right after we wrapped up our podcast, which you all got to listen to Saturday after we were coming back from Niagara Falls, it was starting to rain. It was, like, getting very dark outside. And all of a sudden, a couple hundred feet ahead of us in our lane, I see... looked like an SUV, who all of a sudden just veers to the left. They're on the furthermost left lane, and they veer to the left, and I could only imagine that they, like, nodded off or something at the wheel, and then it's like when you quickly realize, like, you hit the side and you hear that vibration, you kind of overcompensate because you worry that you're veering off, and that's what this person did, where they just hung to the right, and then all of a sudden it was like this SUV had lost balance. And as soon as I saw this swerve, I was like, oh, shit. And me and Wei are just watching this SUV go left and right and swerving through this lane. And then all of a sudden, it makes like a fucking 90-degree turn into the middle lane. I think it hit a car as it was about to go over, hit this car, and continued to just smash into the median path and goes right across all three lanes of the highway.
Yeah.
This is like all these cars going fucking 120 kilometers an hour, and then suddenly Wei is just reacting to this. This is like a video game where all these cars are maneuvering out of the way of this SUV. I think like two or three cars ended up with like crashing during this part, with this SUV taking the worst of it, just nosedived into the median. And there was a guy right in front of us that went over to the left side, Waze going there too, and has to slam on his brakes as we screech up to his car. And like, it must have been like, what, way 2 feet?
Not even.
Like,
not
it was even. So close. Like, Wei thought we had hit the car. I knew we hadn't. And then Wei gets out. He's, like, surveying the damage. We're watching this other SUV that's just fucking totaled here going into this median. And all the people from the SUV got out. They seemed to be okay.
They seemed fine.
No one was hurt in all of this, thankfully. But it was crazy. And then, like, on top of that, nobody fucking stops. It's just like, oh, these fuckers. Get to the side. Well, we got to get going.
It's pretty hard to stop when everybody's going 120.
But even then, when you wanted to get back into the lane, it's like no one's letting you in just to... You're at zero. That's a really dangerous thing to do on the highway, where you're at zero and you've got to pick up... And this car was ahead of us, so it's not like we could have even driven down this part to pick up speed and...
No, the shoulder was very narrow, too, so there wasn't much...
Because you went to go out, and we almost got nailed by a guy.
Yeah.
By his car. So that's very, and then me and Wei were just like silent for like the next like half hour, pretty much.
Yeah. We were both stunned.
Oh, dude, I was like, I don't want to drive ever again after that experience.
But I'd be lying if I said, you know, one of my initial reactions was, shit, we should have kept recording our podcast.
I was glad we weren't, because think of that. I think the podcast in the car idea. Like, dude, had you been swerving and this fucking microphone had fallen off your little armrest and, like, hit you in the lap, like, you could have fucking gone into a car or something. As you're violently fucking switching lanes?
Yeah, maybe.
That would have been... We end the podcast like that and just post it.
Oh,
what a cliffhanger.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Anyway, drive safe, folks, and don't... Yeah. And don't fall asleep at the wheel.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened to you?
It has. Yeah, all the time. It's really bad.
All the time?
Yeah. Yeah, because I have long rides. I mean, it used to all the time. Ever since I've been going to jiu-jitsu, though, like, it's one of the biggest reasons why I started. It's just so, my open mat's downtown, so, like, anytime... Basically, I go to work, and then I go to jiu-jitsu, and that basically it bypasses all the traffic. So by the time I get out of class...
Traffic is the worst, man. Like, I just, like, sitting there on a highway in traffic, it's like, man, my sensories just go off.
One of my other tricks is, like, to just, like, rap.
You rap?
Yeah, in the car.
Like what?
Well, just, like, you play, like, one of your favorite songs, like,
Wu-Tang.
Yeah, or, what is it? Give Me the Loop by B.I.G., and then you just... like stay awake, because there's something like it always works no matter what, no matter how tired I am. Like trying to remember lyrics will wake you up.
Yeah, I remember going to my prom in like a decade ago, and then we all went to this party afterwards, and everyone just stayed over at this house, and I didn't sleep, but I had to drive these people home. Holy Christ. It was just like...
Yeah.
There was one moment where I like fucking like shook my head, and it's like I was dozing off sleeping. I was like, this is fucking dangerous.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So I try to avoid at all costs ever driving when I'm tired. I have pulled over before. I think sometimes we're too proud and we're like, oh, I'm almost there.
Yeah, I agree. That's bullshit. There should be sleep stations.
They should have stuff in cars where it's like you can press a button and it like mist comes out of your like glove compartment or something and sprays you in the face, like just wakes you up or something.
A button, okay, that's not.
Or comes out of your mirror or something.
It's
just
a terrible.
It's
idea.
Just like like the you know that Pepsi Zone thing at Canada's Wonderland or that mist zone.
I mean, it could be.
Okay. You know what I'm talking about?
Like a Pepsi mist zone inside the car.
No, that's water, though. It's not Pepsi. Pepsi would keep you awake, too, but it would give you an...
See, I think that could be either really good or really dangerous. What if you were wide awake and then somebody just hits that button?
Some little kid just is playing around.
And all of a sudden, water is spraying in your face as you're trying to drive.
I'm just throwing out ideas. I don't have to back them up.
They should have some type of feature. Like, they should... some type of, like, skill testing question every 100 miles. You know? Just to get your brain...
Wet. Yeah. Recite the next 5 words in In the Loop by Biggie.
Yeah.
Right now.
Exactly.
Boom, your car's dead.
Yeah, true.
They have some of that for cars now where it's like you got to pass a breathalyzer to, I guess it's not something new.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you, I think if you're convicted, they might install that.
I think everyone should have that.
Sure. I mean, yeah, sure. Every car should have that. I mean, is it that big of a problem?
Drinking and driving?
I mean, it's a bit of an issue for people. For the general population. I mean, I'm fine with it right now where only the people that are, I don't know, kind of at risk are have to do it. Why would you inconvenience everybody?
Yeah, but it's like you're saying that, well, in order for you to be safe on the road, you first have to commit some crime related to this before we're going to step in and do something. All cars should just be made with that. It's like you should have a passive breathalyzer to drive a vehicle.
I suppose.
It's like a seatbelt.
Yeah, I mean, if they wanted to do that, I wouldn't be too opposed to it.
I would not.
I don't know. I mean, it's just never an issue for me, so.
Nor me, so I wouldn't have any issue with it. But there's some asshole out there who's like, that's impeding my rights as a human.
No, that's fine. Yeah, they should do that.
Well, the highway to hell, it was much more calm going into Madison Square Garden in August of 1998. This was, as we said, an extremely hot period, and the whole summer here was built around... Vince McMahon was convinced that The Undertaker and Kane were working in cahoots. That was the word of the summer in 1998. Cahoots. It was the first time I ever heard this term.
Really?
And it was the term Vince always used. You're in cahoots.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a word I've never used myself. But it was a word that sold 700,000 buys for this show. And with Steve Austin, the WWF champion at the time, he was... at his huge popularity peak at this point. Meanwhile, WCW, the 2 weeks before this show, presented Road Wild featuring Jay Leno in the main event and a Travis Tritt concert that we have reviewed. So that was the competition at the time.
Jeez. Okay.
It's pretty nuts when you consider that the month before this, WCW did that Bash at the Beach with Dennis Rodman and Carl Malone.
Mm-hmm.
So you had WCW putting on... like their biggest pay-per-view ever, and then a month later, it was like 700,000 people bought this SummerSlam. Wrestling was
very hot,
pretty popular in 1998. Yeah. Now, Wei, you watched my DVD copy of this.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the majority of this on the DVD, and then the rest I found online. This DVD, because of all the shit that they have to change to it with the blurring of the logos, they couldn't use the AC/DC Highway to Hell song.
Oh, okay.
I thought that this, watching this, it was, maybe I'm a bit of a snob, but this was fucking so annoying with all the, first of all, the hard camera faces like the Madison Square Garden entrance. So you've got this gate with the WWF logo on it. So you're staring at this blur the entire time along with all the turnbuckles.
Mm-hmm.
I hated this. I hated this so much. I'm so glad they have now figured this out so that they can release clean copies of their events. But I thought that this drastically took away from this.
Well, for me, like I'm so used to it that it didn't really bother me anymore. But I think about that, and I think about why that they instituted this, because, I mean, at no point would anybody ever confuse that Scratch logo with anything else. Like, what is the purpose? Why would they do that?
You've got to imagine. Like, and it must have cost them tons of money to go back and blur all this shit, mm-hmm. and now go back and unblur. Well, I guess they have, like, the masters and stuff, so I guess it's less of an issue. But they had that. I mentioned the AC/DC thing. There was also, like, they changed Mark Marrow's theme music.
Yeah.
So, and it's, like, it's not seamless either. It's, like, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler are either gone or you hear them so faintly talking in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I hated this.
Yeah.
Thumbs down, show.
What was his theme music before?
It was just like some in-house thing. It wasn't like some commercial artist or anything like that. It was a different theme he had here that they put on the DVD release. So sometimes they run into those issues.
Was it the Rocky theme or something?
No. It was just this like fucking electric guitar riff that he used to come into. Anyway, the opening video featured the whole summer storyline of whether The Undertaker and Kane are working together. And then, as I mentioned, the opening here where... I always remember Jim Ross. I remember watching this pay-per-view at my buddy Sean's house, and it was a bunch of us. We all got together, and this was one of the first pay-per-views This actually might have been the first pay-per-view I ever watched live when I think about it.
Wow.
Because forever it was the scramble vision and shit. Mm-hmm. And then finally I found a friend who had a black box and he used to always do the, you guys are always welcome to come over. And then come the Sunday, I'd be like calling him. I'm like, hey man, I want to come watch the pay-per-view. I'm going out or just wasn't around. I was like, man.
What a day.
And none of my other friends, they were like, oh, whatever. We don't have to watch it. I was like, fuck, I want to watch the pay-per-view.
Yeah.
So finally, SummerSlam 1998, my friends were so into it. They really wanted to watch it. My buddy was home and we all went to his place and watched SummerSlam 1998.
That's huge.
So that's my recollection.
So
of this.
Before that, you would watch Scramble Vision and like rent tapes.
Yeah, pretty much. That was my outlet for pay per view at the age of 14. Mm. Very sad, but anyway, that's the dues you pay as a wrestling fan.
Yep. Now look at you.
Yeah.
You watch every single.
Pollock, man, grow up. We had D'Lo Brown defending the European title in the opening match against Val Venus, and Venus came out, and he used to do always his opening hello to the audience, where he said, I came, I saw, and I came again.
No.
And the crowd cheered his sperm being thrust upon them.
Oh.
Or him having an erection and ejaculating here.
Well, I'm sure he's been to New York. Like, it's not his first time to
New
York.
The crowd loved this. This was the short window where Val Venus was a really, really popular character.
Yeah.
And then quickly became he was still doing this character 2 years later, and it was a little tough to still be the porn star.
Yeah. I just like how they always cut to the shots of the women whenever he does this.
Yeah, I'm sure there were guys here that were just as intrigued by this.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever see this? Going into this, this was a few weeks after the choppy, choppy your pee-pee angle.
No, I've never seen that.
That's a Raw I want to review.
Okay.
Why haven't we reviewed that yet?
I don't know.
With the cliffhanger, literally, and then the following week with John Bobbitt.
Oh.
It's a two-parter.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah. I probably have never seen that Raw because I guarantee you that did not air in Canada.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. You imagine being like a TSN producer or something and it's like suddenly you just, you know, wrestling is evolving, but you're not really aware of the content changes, and all of a sudden you're staring at a man's ass and a samurai sword is coming down to chop his dick off.
Yeah.
And you have to go to like the segment producer who's busy like getting ready for tonight's Blue Jays game and ask him this question about what's our policy when it comes to castration. So Val Venus is out. They introduced D'Lo Brown hailing from Helsinki, Finland, because every week he'd be billed from a new European city as European champion. And this was during his run with the chest protector.
Mm-hmm.
This was done when Dan Severn stretched him during a match. And then the following week he came back with the chest protector. And this was arguably his most popular. Everyone remembers D'Lo Brown, European champion, with the chest protector.
Yeah, both him and Val Venus.
Yeah, these two characters were both kind of at their peak at this point, with no disrespect towards his role as the VP.
Yeah.
That has recently ran through. You could see Bill Apter here at ringside shooting.
Cool. Also Jimmy Suzuki.
Yes. Oh, your pal.
Yes.
Has he ever been in contact with you since WrestleMania?
No.
That's really shitty. You know what also sucked? There was a WWE photographer at that same press conference, and he came up to me, and he was like, I saw you at Access yesterday doing an interview with Ricky Steamboat, and he's got like professional gear here, shooting and stuff. I took a photo of you interviewing Ricky Steamboat. I was just wondering if you'd want me to email it to you. I was like, absolutely, man. Like, cool shot of me interviewing Ricky Steamboat. Would love to have it. So I wrote down my email address, gave it to him, never received it. I was so disappointed. I was like, yeah. I'd love to see this, a high quality photograph with Ricky Steamboat of all people, like, would have been really cool. Never heard from him. Maybe him and Jimmy Suzuki, they compared notes and they're like, oh, these assholes, they do a podcast, they just fucking hate wrestling.
Yeah
fuck them. They showed an angle on Sunday Night Heat from earlier. Actually, this had nothing to do with the match, but they brought it up about Steve Austin destroying a hearse. And there was they went off the air on Heat with the burning question, was The Undertaker in the hearse? And leaving the viewer with the question of whether the main event will happen or not. Strange way to go off the pre-show.
Yeah.
Pay money to find out.
I didn't really understand any of that.
Venus hit a spine buster and got a two count, and then they cut to Edge, who was standing in the crowd. The Strange Enigma, Jim Ross called him. And, originally, the guy who was going to play the Val Venus character.
Right.
Yeah. My way, how his career might have gone different if his name had been Val Venus.
Yeah.
The Rated X superstar.
Or, I mean, what would Val Venus have been?
Yeah, imagine he had been.
Edge.
Yeah. VNC. Val and... He might have come in as Val, or he might have been...
Val and Christian?
Remember when they called Adam Copeland, when he first came in, they called him The Edge.
Yeah.
Man, our phones are just going off like mental here. Driving me crazy. Venus came off the top going for his finish, which was a frog splash, at the time called the Money Shot.
Mm-hmm.
I love thinking of, like, newer wrestling fans that listen to this and hearing these characters, and, like, one of them had a finish called the Money Shot.
It's pretty clever.
Oh, they were very clever.
Because it's a big splash.
It's just so funny to watch this and be like, this is so different from, like, what WWE is today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we would send Val
Dean. It's not all that different.
Yeah, it's just characters that you would never see today.
I guess.
With the Money Shot. Brown hit a DDT for a two count, and the crowd really popped here for that near fall. Venus came back with a double arm suplex and then a scoop slam, goes for the Money Shot, but D'Lo gets his knees up, and the crowd then really starts getting into D'Lo here. They're chanting for D'Lo, and I guess D'Lo got really excited here by the crowd chanting for him. He went for his running power bomb, but ends up dropping Venus. And look terrible.
Yeah, it's a very dangerous move.
Yes, as we would find out a year later. And then he goes for it again, and he completed it, but still dropped Val kind of awkwardly. I mean, you watch this, and it's like, was this really a move that you needed to keep around? You know what I mean?
I mean Liger does it all the time.
Well, I'm not gonna compare D'Lo Brown to Liger. Anyway, Venus gets out of the way of a frog splash from D'Lo, and then Venus takes the chest protector off of D'Lo, puts it on himself, and he climbs up to the top as the star of the match, Jimmy Corderas, comes over and is admonishing Val and ends up arguing with him to the point that he accidentally crotches Val on the top rope. And then Jim Ross is giving Corderas shit for getting involved and putting his hands on an athlete. Venus recovers, then he tosses Jimmy to the side, and then climbs up, but Jimmy calls for the bell at 15:25, giving D'Lo the win by disqualification. Really shitty final 2 minutes, I thought.
I thought Jimmy was totally in the wrong here.
Well, I mean, Val was about to commit an illegal act here.
Yeah, so what?
But the referee is supposed to officiate, not...
Why is D'Lo allowed to wear this chest protector but not Val Venus?
Well, he has an injury. It's like wearing a cast.
Still not fair.
Well, Val certainly acted out of line here. They got quite a lot of time here. 15 minutes and 25 seconds for these two in the opener. But I just thought the finish really sucked after that amount of time. The power bomb, the match kind of fell apart at that point. But up until then, I mean, the crowd was really into both guys.
I thought it was quite average. Just average heavyweights wrestling.
After the match, Venus slammed Jimmy and gave Jimmy the Money Shot.
Ooh.
And then gyrated over top of him. Poor Corderas. Michael Cole is in the back near the hearse, and Mankind is there surveying it and says it was him inside of the hearse. And now his hearse is ruined that he was going to come out to the ring with for his special SummerSlam surprise.
So what was the point of all that? For this?
Just to tease that, I don't know.
It was just to show Austin destroying something, I guess.
Yeah, so Mankind was destroyed in a hearse, but he's going to go forward with his match, and he has a sledgehammer now.
And there's a guy underneath the hearse.
Yeah, he was like working on it, like giving it a tune-up or something.
Oh, God.
So, don't know what was going on there, as they did like a close-up of this guy's legs.
Yeah.
They introduced the Insane Clown Posse, who were there live to do the entrance theme for the Oddities. As they come out, crowd loved ICP.
Sure. Yeah.
I love this theme song. When it first came out, I remember this was on like WWF The Music Volume 3.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the only song I really enjoyed on that CD was the Oddities theme.
Oh, really?
It was a great tune.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny here. You had Golga, Kurgan, and Luna, who's from the Vachon family, not actually born in Canada, but the Vachons are. So it's like three quarters of the oddities are Canadian here.
Oh, I didn't know they were the other ones were Canadian.
Yeah, Golgo was from Vancouver. Kurgan was born, I believe he was, yeah, he was born somewhere in Canada.
Oh, wow.
And can be seen on Bloor Street every now and then.
Okay.
Yeah. And, of course, Giant Silva, who would go on to compete in Pride.
What is he doing on Bloor Street?
Dude, there was one night, we were going to Dance Cave, and all of a sudden it's Kurgan, and...
He's a movie star now.
Yeah, but he was shooting a movie here in Toronto or something, and he's just wandering around Bloor Street.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, Giant Silva would go on to fight in Pride, and also form maybe the worst tag team of all time with the Great Khali in New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, this is a whole group, but basically of Great Khalis.
Golgo was like the worker of the three.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taking on Kai and Tai, a rare occurrence where it was all four members of Kai and Tai, Taka Michinoku, Sho Funaki, Dick Togo, and Men's Teo. Mm-hmm. And they show them mocking ICP and the oddities in the back as they come out in something that was literally a sign of the times. A guy in the front row had a sign that read, "Golga is a retard." What a hateful sign to go out of your way to create. The babyface Golga.
I think you would still see that today.
They'd probably confiscate it now.
Maybe.
Remember when we went to Raw the night after Mania and we were in line waiting as they were like confiscating signs and it was like stuff like Cena sucks. They were like taking away, like they were taking like some of the most tame signs away.
Yeah.
Anyway. What did you think of the Golga character, Way? Because here this guy was like, most people knew who Earthquake was, and they brought him back for such an odd role here as Golga. I guarantee there were many people who had no clue ever that this was John Tenta under this mask.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel like it might have been punishment, just to get back at a guy. Or maybe they just felt like Earthquake was very
cosmetically
stale.
They felt he needs a mask?
I don't know. I mean, South Park was really big at the time.
Yeah, this is... let me tell you, it's like watching this show with, like, Golga, the New Age Outlaws come out in their airbrushed, like, South Park shirts. It was like, man, I totally remember that time period. I even bought a South Park shirt.
South Park was huge.
It was so popular at this time. This was just after, like, season one.
Yeah, South Park, it used to air on
Global
up here. And it used to air at, like, something like 12 o'clock at night on a weekday. Or Friday or something, and I think it was
Fridays. I remember that.
It was just very shocking at the time to everybody because, here's a cartoon show that was not at all for children. And I remember, it was just all the rage amongst, all us. Like, we were just starting high school at the time, and I remember one of my friends, being like, my dad's not going to let me watch it. We started watching it, and then Kenny died, and that's when we had to turn it off. And I'm like, that happens every episode.
Do you remember the big cliffhanger they had where it was who was Cartman's dad?
Yeah, yeah.
And it like went on, like they didn't do any new episodes for like ever.
They did a Terrence and Phillip episode.
Yeah.
Instead, yeah.
I remember.
That was that first season though.
Yeah.
That was, it's grown, that show has matured so much since then.
Oh, absolutely.
In some ways, but not in others. But it's gotten much more political in recent years, of course.
Yeah, but for like being 14 years old, I loved that show at the time.
Yeah, it was great, yeah. I think it's one of the great shows.
Did you have that... Because, you're right. This was like right at the end of the summer in 98. Did you... And when you started high school, did you have that month-long strike in September? Or did you start school right away?
I don't remember.
I remember we got a month off. We got an extra month of the summer that year.
Weren't you in like a Catholic school?
Yeah, I went to a Catholic
school. I'm not sure if we did. I don't remember.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you were a public school, right?
Yeah.
So literally, this was like a week before you met Gordon.
Gordon didn't come to my school until like maybe about like grade 10 and grade 11.
Oh, he transferred.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. That would have been cool. We should have had Gordon on then. Anyway, Golga brings a shoe to the ring, which happens to be Yamaguchi-san's, and he pours something in it and then splashes it into Yamaguchi-san's face. And the match began. It was 4-on-3, and we saw Kurgan in here with three of the members of Kai and Tai, just overpowers them, did a bunch of comedy spots, then Silva got tagged in, and... pretty much it was Kai and Tai just bumping for these big monsters.
Kai and Tai were basically playing doors for these giants to toss around.
Hey, and they played a great friggin' ping pong balls here.
I suppose, yeah.
Like 3 minutes into this, Jim Ross just says, "We never advertised this to be a classic." Poor Taka Michinoku here. He was like the star of their big... He was like their answer to Rey Mysterio in the Cruiserweight division. And then, like, less than a year into his run, he's like...
Doing
Kai and Tai, wearing a Nike cutoff shirt and jean shorts.
Nike cutoff shirt?
He had this sleeveless shirt with, like, a Nike symbol on it. Like, that was his ring gear for this match.
Really?
Nike symbol? Yeah. They were not sponsoring Taka, I don't think.
Well, I mean, as a fan of, like, Kai and Tai from
I love this group.
Michinoku Pro, like, or even some of their ECW stuff, you would see what they were capable of. Just some of the best, like, six-man, eight-man tag team matches that I'd ever seen. And then to see them, like, basically, in Michinoku Pro, they're pretty much like the NWO, you know, like the top heel faction of the company.
Oh, yeah.
And then to be brought over to the WWE and basically be given the status of, like, okay, these jobbers to this group of giant dancing idiots was kind of disheartening.
At one point, Ross compared Giant Silva to Andre the Giant, a comparison that really has not played.
They're both giants.
Played out, yes. They both... This happened when he put Kai and Tai in the corner and attacked them with his ass, a trademark Andre spot. And then Irish whips each guy into the corner, and then military press Taka to the floor onto the other members of Kai and Tai. Teo and Funaki eventually slam Golga, all get on top with splashes off the top, and then repeated elbow drops, and then they all pose. I just thought these guys were great. Awesome. They had so much charisma.
Yep.
And just
great, like, triple team, quadruple team moves. You know, and you'll see way more of this if you watch some of their Japanese work.
Kurgan then came in with a sidewalk slam. All four members of Kai and Tai took choke slams by Kurgan and Silva. And then Luna took out Yamaguchi-san, and Golga just jumped on top of all four and pinned them simultaneously at 10 minutes and 12 seconds. Kai and Tai were the stars of this match.
Yeah, but I mean...
Not much to
overall, like, pretty messy match.
And went way too long. Like, this... Why you look at this... Kurgan and Giant Silva, we're going to put them out there for 10 minutes. A little ambitious. And then ICP performed again. And again, I think ICP were the most over of anyone out here for this match. They really dug them. The Juggalos in the house.
Yep.
And then we went to the hair versus hair match, kind of, with Jeff Jarrett accompanied by the former Godwins, who had been repackaged as Southern Justice. Mm-hmm. And that meant wearing suits and... Tying your hair back and wearing shades. Yeah. Southern Justice. So Jarrett against X-Pac. This had been set up after Jarrett had been shaving people's heads all summer. And then X-Pac broke into the locker room and he urinated into Jeff Jarrett's cowboy boots.
Shut up.
Yeah, really? That's the angle.
Oh, my God.
Piss.
Because this is like, it's similar to what he would do in real life, right? Shit in people's bags?
Yeah, this was the tamer version, just piss.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the deal. It was X-Pac, I think, who, like, shit in Sable's, like, carry-on luggage
or
something.
Shit in a lot of people's bags.
Well, yeah, it was X-Pac was the one who did it to Juventud Guerrera, then led to this big fight with Jack Evans backstage with Hoovy and him.
That's the X-Pac special.
Oh, the X, yeah. I'm sure I could come up with something clever, but I'm not going to spend time on that. X-Pac came out with his... DX member for the evening, Howard Finkel, who was attacked on Sunday Night Heat by the three, Jarrett and Southern Justice, and then they shaved his head. This was the end of Howard's hair, which continues to this day.
Yeah, he didn't have much of it to begin with, though.
No, not a whole lot. He was like, he had kind of the horseshoe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Finkel comes out and does the crotch chop with X-Pac that looked just so incredibly awkward. Like...
He's still got a bow tie on as well.
Oh, they just, my goodness, the parodies they have put this man through, just looking so silly. And then gives him the microphone to yell, X-Pac says, if you ain't down with us, then we got two words for you. And Howard Finkel in his deepest, like, baritone voice, suck it. So the match begins. X-Pac hit a really cool spinning heel kick to Jarrett and then clotheslined him to the floor and then came off the top with a cross body. And X-Pac never really jumps out at you, but it's like you watch some of these matches and it's like this guy at the time was 26 years old.
Yeah.
He was only 26 in 98. Look how much he had already done by that point.
Yeah.
He was such a talented guy.
Yeah.
Like, it's really sad, like, post, like, 99. Like, just, I mean, he fell into a lot of problems, and it's just, it's too bad, because this guy is literally, like, one of the more talented guys that have come around over the last 20 years, I believe.
I completely agree.
That is never really considered, you know? He's got a very underrated guy, I think.
I've always said that. Anytime we watch an X-Pac match from one of these shows, he always stands out. I mean, doesn't really stand out. Maybe that's the wrong word. But he always impresses me with how hard he works. His style is always fast. He always, like, he's not lazy at all. Like, the complete opposite.
Always crisp, always hitting his stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, the problems, though, I think eventually came to be whatever there was behind the scenes. But also, just he never really evolved his character, nor his look.
That was the big negative, at least within the WWE at the time.
I mean,
outside of that breath of fresh air with Uncle Cracker.
Yo, you dealing with the X Factor.
I got everything I ever wanted, and I'll never give that back.
Yo.
Oh, I know you hate X Factor, but you ain't gotta look at me like that. I said you ain't gotta look at me.
God,
love that song.
But yeah, his look as well. I mean, you know, at this time though, this was 1998. He had just come back a few months earlier. He was perhaps one of the hottest people in the whole company. But you know, he's pretty much still rocking the same look, like 13, 15 years later. And
his name is still a playoff of X-Pac
or Tupac.
Tupac is what I meant.
Yeah.
It was funny, last weekend when we were in Niagara Falls, we were waiting for you to arrive on the Friday, and we went to this Texas bar, and they had, it was just like empty, except for a few people at the bar, and they had Vintage Collection on, and the whole show was like the history of DX, and it featured Waltman coming in the night after WrestleMania, cutting that promo, and then it's all like DX matches from like 98, 99, and this one guy, he was there by himself, just glued to the TV. And there was this match with X-Pac and Road Dogg against Billy Gunn in China. And it was from, like, Fully Loaded 99 with the rights to the letters DX on the line.
Okay.
And Road Dogg and X-Pac got the win. And this guy was like, yeah! And it was just, I don't know what it was other than like being here in Niagara Falls and watching a guy just get so happy at the outcome of a 14-year-old match.
You probably thought it was new.
It was so awesome. It was just so great.
Yeah.
This man was so excited. Anyway, back to this match. Jarrett applied the figure four and X-Pac got out, back suplex Jarrett, hit a sit-out powerbomb for a two count, and then runs at Jarrett into the corner and bounces off the top ass first. Which just brings back his ass tearing a couple of months ago when I watched these kind of spots.
Yeah.
And Jarrett hits a low blow, then nails Finkel on the apron, turns around into the X Factor, but Jarrett kicks out, and Southern Justice goes to get involved, and Dennis Knight has a guitar in his hands, which X-Pac stops, he ducks the guitar shot, grabs the guitar, nailing Dennis Knight off the apron, and then the referee runs across the ring as X-Pac nails Jarrett over the head with this guitar, like the most blatant guitar shot that this referee has to play dumb for. And with the guitar debris all throughout the ring, X-Pac pins Jarrett at 11 minutes and 12 seconds, and Jarrett has to have his head shaved. I mean, just a come on. It's like, at least make this convincing to me.
You listen, I'm,
like, have the ref on the floor, have him, like, in a corner somewhere. Like, he literally ran across and, like, had his head turned, so he couldn't see, and let's just forget about his hearing at this point, of a guitar going over a man's head.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of leeway that's afforded to these, you know, incidents. I mean, if the referees in pro wrestling only seem to be able to focus on one thing at a time, and I don't know, maybe he has ADD.
I guess so. So then the New Age Outlaws run out with chairs to chase off the heels, along with Darren Drozdoff and the Headbangers, who have all been attacked by Jarrett and Southern Justice over the past couple of weeks. And Jarrett is put into a seat, and they go to shave his head as Jarrett is yelling at Mike Chioda, "The hell you didn't see the guitar! The hell you didn't!"
He's great.
And then they pretty much just give up on shaving his head, and he goes to the back with no haircut.
No, he had
it was minor
looks.
Way, very
well,
minor.
Problem is, anytime you do one of these live haircuts after a hair versus hair match, it's always a little awkward because in reality, it takes quite a while to completely shave a man's head, and
took this like 12 minutes,
just with like what.
A razor.
Okay, but you don't have 12 minutes. You don't have 12 minutes in front of a crowd. When
a razor, dude, you just fucking can totally take it. All people want is one visual, just through the middle.
Yeah, but you had shorter hair than Jared did before.
Wow.
You know,
anyway.
Like you had like Finkel level hair.
Okay, but I mean, the point is, I had Finkel level hair.
What I mean is like the length of your hair. I mean, Jared had like locks. You're supposed to cut that stuff first before you can shave it down. But, you know, it always looks a little awkward because it also requires the person getting the cut to hold perfectly still, which, you know, they can't really do because they have to act like they're struggling.
He was just hit with a guitar.
Yeah, but he was still struggling. He was still conscious.
They should have had him out cold then from the guitar.
Whatever. Like any time I've ever seen one of these, it always looks a little awkward.
Well, I hate that they don't give you the payoff on the pay-per-view. And then the next night, he's got like some crew cut. Like, you know what I mean? He didn't even have to have a serious like head shaving, you know? Lame. Come on.
Sure.
Were you excited about the next appearance?
Not really.
Method Man.
Well, he was sitting... Yeah,
he had some shitty seats.
Method Man was here, and they sat him in the back of the arena.
Do you think they didn't know who he was?
They obviously knew. They keyed him.
I guess someone clued them in. From the Wu-Tang Clan, Jim Ross told us.
I know. He's a huge wrestling fan.
Yeah, he did that thing with John Cena, I remember, a while ago. They did, like, a magazine cover. And
oh, yeah?
Did they do a song together or something?
I don't know. But I'm pretty sure he was on that Aggression soundtrack as well. Yeah. And he references, like, you know, wrestlers in his songs all the time.
You should get him on, Way.
He's probably too busy.
Oh, you could. I think you could make it happen.
Sure, he's done a ton of pro wrestling interviews already.
I've never heard of him do any. You should be the first. That's really, like, your niche.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the first.
Rappers.
Nah, it's not a big deal.
Wei Ting Presents.
No, I don't think so.
You could call it, like, Wei Ting Feet.
What?
Like, featuring. The short form. And then every week you have a new person in there. Waiting featuring Method Man. Waiting featuring Pusha T.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great idea. Thanks. I'll write that down.
These are golden ideas that I just present to you. Okay. And you just shit on them.
Waiting feet.
Shit on them like your name's X-Pac or something.
Oh, God.
And my ideas are my carry-on bag. Michael Cole is with The Rock in the back. All I saw was blurring here. It looked like there was like some like penises here throughout this backstage area. And they show the angle of from Sunday Night Heat where The Rock attacked Triple H with his belt to the right knee, which was a legit injury Hunter had and would end up having to take some significant time off after this match. So he went through this ladder match with going into this with a fucked up knee. I think he was out till like January. So
oh, wow.
It was a serious injury. And cuts a quick promo as The Rock. He was, like, super over as a heel here. And the crowd was, like, starting to really get behind Rock here because he was just so damn entertaining here throughout this run. This was when he was, like, leading the nation after Farooq left.
Yeah, and, you know, I really missed out on a lot of this stuff on his, like, kind of ascent into, the main event. And so it was interesting for me to watch him cut a promo at this stage of his career where he would, like, do his whole thing, but, like, he wouldn't even... Like, where a lot of his catchphrases weren't even really established yet, so, like, he would say, you know, millions and millions without even taking a breath to let the audience say it for him.
His song would start off with, like, a slow, do you smell what The Rock is cooking?
Yeah.
It was, like, such a different, like, delivery of all his
lines.
It was
like listening to, like, a demo track of, like, a really popular song.
Yeah. I remember my friends, they just fucking, when they saw the People's Elbow... It's like the greatest move ever.
Yeah.
It's like that was all they wanted to see.
Yeah.
It's like the People's Elbow.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got the mixed tag here with Mark Mero and Jacqueline coming out to some weird theme here. So I couldn't, it was like, it, and it drowns out Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler.
There's got to be a good reason for that. I'm sure somebody, maybe
someone
a
get on it.
Would know.
Someone fact check this shit. And they were taking on Sable and the elusive mystery partner.
Ooh.
And Sable comes out. Well, first Mero and Jacqueline are, I like to call them, this was Wolfpack Mark Mero, because he had switched from, he was wearing like black and gray for the longest time. And then here, when he teamed up with Jacqueline, they switched to red and black. And it was right at the time of the Wolfpack as well. It was the same like turnover.
Maybe there's some secret alliance there.
Yeah. So Sable comes out. This was all set up after Jacqueline and Sable had an arm wrestling challenge, and Jacqueline dropped the table onto Sable's ribs, and Sable gets on the mic. You can barely hear her here. It was like you had like the arena feed here on this microphone. Hmm. You could barely hear her. And
Yeah, they forgot to switch the mics. Yeah.
Very amateur hour here.
Yes.
And out comes Edge from the crowd. Zero connection here between these two. It was just a random pairing, and it never led anywhere after this. It was like they went their separate ways after this match. It was like, we just got to fill this spot, and that's it.
They're both blonde.
Clearly. Yeah. Yep. So there you go. That was the connection. Edge and Rena Mero, the blondes. So the match begins. Edge hit a tilt-a-whirl leg scissors to Mero and then tagged out as Sable, who just had this screeching voice that she would yell.
Sable definitely had her screaming voice here. Oh. I never heard her use that often.
No, she just like...
This is probably what she sounds like at home, like with Brock, like when Brock doesn't take out the trash.
Yeah. Do you ever read Brock's book?
No.
He describes when him and Sable broke up and... She just didn't want anything to do with him. And so he got into a plane, flew to where she lives, and went to her house, and she wasn't home. So he climbs into the house, gets through a window, and then like...
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's freaky.
I would shit my
pants. Then he calls her from the phone. So imagine, dude, you were like living on your own, and you get a phone call, and it's like your house number.
Wow.
And it's Brock Lesnar. And then he just skips over and he's like, and then we ended up making up and it was happily ever after.
Well, imagine if you're like, a single woman just sitting at your desk in your room, and all of a sudden this fucking 350-pound gorilla climbs up into your window and just like, fuck.
He jumps onto the ledge like when he does his entrance and jumps to the ring. Pyro comes out of the house.
That would scare the shit out of me.
Fucking crazy story. But
well, that's true love.
And now they live in the woods, disconnected from the world. Anyway, Edge counters a TKO attempt by Mero into a DDT. The women come in. Sable hits this double leg takedown on Jacqueline and just gives the weakest punches ever. Like, man, it doesn't register until I go back and watch these, how bad Sable was.
This was not
This was not bad as that Tori match we reviewed from this WrestleMania.
I thought Sable was pretty good in this match.
She was when she was like, that's because I think Edge did the majority here, but
even some of the, like,
she was fine in short bursts.
Yeah,
you're right. Sable ends up hitting. Actually, you're right. She did pull off quite a bit in this. As I look at my notes here, she went. Where was it? Edge. Sable hits a TKO onto Jacqueline, but then Mero pulls Sable off, and Sable's yelling as they attack her on the floor. Then Jacqueline accidentally nails Mark Mero on the apron. It's my favorite spot. Mark Mero is holding Sable on the apron as Jacqueline, with full force, runs at Sable. It's like, what would happen if she had hit Sable? Like, Mero would have probably taken the back of her head into his jaw and then fallen off the apron. And instead, Sable moved, and Jacqueline knocks Mero. I hate that spot in wrestling.
Sacrifice.
From there, Edge hit this incredible... dive to the floor, going over the top rope, and then sends Mero into the steps as Edge, he was like this dark mute at the time, and he did his pose and just yells, like, with his arms out. Mm-hmm. Like, you think that lightning's going to come from the sky. And then Jacqueline runs at Edge, who spanks Jacqueline, and then back in the ring, Sable hits a Hurricane Rana to Mark Mero off the top rope. That was the most impressive spot. Mm-hmm. By Sable. And the crowd starts chanting for Sable here. And then Edge ends up lifting Sable by the legs and drops her onto Mero for the win at 8:26. And Edge just signs off and runs back into the crowd.
Mm-hmm. I thought this was actually a pretty good match considering, you know, who was involved. I thought Sable's timing was actually really good on a lot of spots. There was one moment where she had to dodge. She had Mero pinned, and then all of a sudden Jackie was diving off the top with a splash, and Sable had to move at the very last second, and she did that, you know, almost perfectly. So I thought she executed her spots very well, and the match overall exceeded my expectations.
Michael Cole is with Mankind in the back. He's holding one of the tag titles. He's supposed to be teaming with Kane later tonight, and says that The Undertaker mentioned that Kane would not be at the show tonight, leaving Mankind on his own to take on the New Age Outlaws, and he's considering forfeiting. But Cole says, but the people want their money's worth. And he gets upset at this. Vince McMahon shows up and starts talking Foley into doing the match, saying, you can fulfill a dream tonight and create a moment at Madison Square Garden. And he begins to grab all these weapons from the back, including a trash can lid with some weapon on top of it, and says,
no, it was like a baking pan.
He says, I'm literally giving you history on a silver platter. And
that's what that was. Yeah. Platter.
And then Mankind reluctantly agrees to go ahead for this handicap match with the New Age Outlaws. Says, if you aren't down with that, I've got 13 words for you. How much wood could a woodchuck wood?
Chuck.
Chuck.
If a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Sure.
Yeah. I probably didn't help that I went into this show completely, like, not watching any of the build, but I was just very confused by Mick Foley's involvement in any of this, like in his skits with the hearse, and then here. It just seemed like really put together last second, and I don't know.
I will rant about the match once we get to it, but it had its issues. Then we got a video promoting the Lion's Den match between Ken Shamrock and Owen Hart.
I didn't even know this was a part of this.
Oh, yes.
How many Lion's Den matches did they actually have?
I think two. Okay. Because the following year they did one on Raw with Ken Shamrock against Vince McMahon. And guess who booked himself to beat Ken Shamrock in a Lion's Den match?
Wow.
What balls. Anyway, the storyline here that Owen Hart has enlisted Dan Severn as his trainer to train against Ken Shamrock.
What is Dan Severn's, like, pro wrestling background?
Oh, he was, like, doing wrestling before MMA. He was, like, an NWA champion, just doing a ton of indies and stuff like that, going all over Japan as well. So, very extensive. He still wrestles to this day. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Does he still do MMA?
He's done MMA. He retired at New Year's this past year. Announced it on January 1st.
That's incredible. I remember seeing Dan Severn appear at, like, a Indian reservation up here in Ontario back when MMA was still...
Is that Warrior One?
No. I don't even remember the name of it.
I know which show you're talking about.
And, he couldn't have been paid more than, I don't know, 400, 500 bucks, like, something like that.
He's one of the weirdest cats out there, man. Whenever I hear, like, interviews with him, he's just like... Well, this is what we did back then, and he's just like this weird guy, man.
Really?
Like, just really weird.
Interesting.
There's one time when we had him on Fight Network Radio, and it was back when we were, the early days of the show. We tried to cram in three guests into one show, mm-hmm. and we left the last 10 minutes for, we had this segment called Blast from the Past, okay. which was like, didn't realize it till we had like a guest on and they hear the intro. It's like, it's like literally like a door cranking open and that's like the sound effects.
Okay.
Like, Fight Network Radio presents Creek Blast from the Past. I'm like, this is the most like such an insulting intro for a guy. And we went late with our last guest. So we have Dan Severn come on with 2 minutes left in the show. And Moro literally asks him one question. Well, what are you up to, Dan? And he's like, well, I'm into this. And then the music starts like, well, Dan, we got to do this again sometime. And he freaking puts him on hold. It's like, we got to get out of here. And then I got to explain to Dan. I'm like, I'm so sorry. He's like, well, yeah, that was pretty quick. I would hope that we could do this again so I could talk a bit. It was the worst. And after that, I'm like, no, man, two guests a show is all we need. We do not need three.
Here's an old guy.
And we retired Blast from the Past after that show. I don't know how many it lasted.
It's good in theory. It was, but yeah.
We did a few where it was like we had taped interviews with older guys, and that was fine. But then when we had a live guest on, I'm like, this is really kind of, not intentionally, but it comes off very rude. Anyway, Owen Hart and Ken Shamrock. This was set up in the theater, which is attached to Madison Square Garden.
I was wondering where this was.
Yeah.
What type of theater did they have?
Well, they used to open up this area when they used to close circuit at the Garden, and there'd be like, you know, an overflow crowd. They'd set them up, but it's attached to Madison Square Garden.
I see.
But shitty here if you've bought tickets to SummerSlam, because it sure as hell, I don't think, was advertised ahead of time that, you know, you wouldn't get to see that. And you got to watch this on a goddamn monitor.
Well, how about the people that actually got into this theater? Did they have to pay for that? Or probably not.
I'm guessing not, but who knows? Because this was a legit sellout. I guess they could have tried to sell tickets to you. No, but you'd have the whole event there on closed circuit, right? Like, you'd get to see the whole show and then one live match. Yeah. Anyway, I feel that Ken Shamrock is the one and only true Scott Putski nominee on this show. He was...
I agree with that.
He was a large man here.
Yes, he was.
Wow. Ross here noting that this is a UFC-style match. This was... Do you want to describe the setup of this? It was like...
Okay, well, the lines then, for those who have not seen it, is basically their take on the octagon. Only the walls are much higher. And
more sides.
More sides. Probably like, I don't know, maybe like a 12... Like, what is it? 12-sided thing?
I think so.
What do you call that? Decagon?
Wrong guy to ask.
And the walls were almost kind of coned. You know, like it was almost like a cone shape where the walls would kind of curve upwards.
It was extremely small, like actual, like...
This actual surface area was quite small, yeah. But
the circumference.
But essentially, it was just a round cage, is what it was.
And then they had the referee on, like, the perimeter on top.
Which
that
there was
went
like
around.
A catwalk built around the top, and that's where the referee stood.
Yeah, so it was just such a strange match here, because...
Like, well, what were your expectations going in?
None. And this is one match where it's like, you really have to understand at the time here, like... Personally, I would have loved to have watched these guys try to emulate a fight, but it's like, had they done this in 98, they would have alienated just about everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That said, even working this, like, they kind of started, like, here, it was like, Shamrock got him against the cage and, like, hit a fireman's carry and then mounted Hart, but then they'd go into wrestling spots, and I could not get into this because it was so incredibly awkward.
It's... You're talking about right now, right? Like, I mean, watching in 2013, as conditioned to mixed martial arts as we are, it's impossible to watch a match like this.
Like, I couldn't turn my brain off for this. It was just, this was so clunky.
He mounted him. Why did he get up from the mount? He was in a dominant position. Why didn't Owen get his back?
It's like Owen just hits him with a low blow as the ref is watching this. There's like Irish whips into the fence, which was interesting. Hart got busted open legit here in the mouth.
Yeah.
And then...
Well, one of the things was, like, they were actually... They were essentially just working a regular wrestling match inside this cage, right? And that was my biggest, I guess, criticism of it. When you say lines, then match, I don't know. I'm expecting something different.
Yeah, me too.
This was just essentially a pro wrestling match inside a different structure. But then, like, they actually go for, like, suplexes and everything. And you have to imagine that this surface, it was not built like a ring, you know. With
they had such little space to work anything with here.
But I mean,
just
the how hard the mat must have been to take some of these bumps in.
Yeah, there was one spot in this, and this reminded me of something current where Owen hit him with an enziguri, and it was like we all know, like the Curtis Axel Triple H thing. It was all built off that Owen Shawn Michaels angle.
Yeah,
and it was with the enziguri, which that move was from that moment on. That move was over. Every time Owen hit that in a match, people reacted like, is this guy going to be out like Michaels was? They got so much out of that. Owen always had a move after that, the enziguri, which was never his finish, but it was always a great spot to go to in a match.
Yeah.
And that's one criticism I would have of the Axel, well, of many criticisms. But had Axel done that, you like, give him some hot move that he can use that was the whole cause of this.
Right, you're saying, okay, but they didn't want to attribute the injury to Curtis Axel.
Well, that was flawed, I think, in and of itself.
Not to them.
As we look back already in hindsight, it's like, what did they get out of it? The guy was cleared 2 weeks later.
Nothing. Oh, it's been weird.
Brock's name hasn't even been brought up.
Yeah, it's been a strange build of Curtis Axel. But you mentioned, you know, something that reminded you of something current from this match. That wasn't the only thing. Ken Shamrock at one point goes for a jump off the fence into a dropkick.
Yes, I wrote this down.
He was basically the originator of the Showtime kick.
Oh, it's so funny. I wrote down literally here the Showtime. He hit
It was like the Showtime clothesline or something
He hit a dropkick first, and then he does it again, but just with the clothesline. So, I mean, Anthony Pettis, obviously, must have been watching SummerSlam 1998.
I swear, the next time I speak to Anthony Pettis, asking him about this.
Show him a clip of this.
Because this is probably the first time anyone's seen this done off a cage.
Gimmick infringement. It should be the Shamrock Kick.
It really should be. Nonetheless, Jim Ross said, "You won't see action like this anywhere else on pay-per-view."
I guess.
Burn.
That's true.
This was immediately followed by a boring chant by the audience who are... I think this just went too long. They just got...
Yeah.
Like, they went 9-17 here, ending when Hart went for the Dragon Sleeper, which was the move that they were really building this around, that Dan Severn was teaching Owen. And I remember my first day ever of doing jiu-jitsu training, they taught us that that's the move. You cannot use this move in training. They said that's the one move you are not to use in practice here. You can do too much damage to someone's neck if you fully lock it on.
Wow.
Like, you're really, like, you're cranking on someone's neck as it's going forward. Like, it's extremely danger. I didn't, but I immediately thought, I just watch it. I think of Ultimo Dragon when I watched the my instructor showing this to us. I'm like, oh, the Dragon Sleeper.
So nobody actually tried it. It was just like...
No. They just said, like, we're going to let you guys roll. This is the one move you cannot use.
Wow. Because, like,
And heel hooks. They didn't want us doing heel hooks.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Anyway, so Shamrock ends up scaling the cage.
See, you could have done the reversal that Ken Shamrock did to the Dragon Sleeper.
Exactly. Flip out and into the ankle lock, and Owen wants the towel thrown in. Dan Severn walks away and leads to Owen tapping out, and the referee calls for it at 9:17, and Hart is left laying in the ring.
I did think the finish was kind of cool. He had him in the Dragon Sleeper.
It was a good transition.
Shamrock just basically ran up the cage to reverse it. But, you know, essentially, like I said, this was just a regular match inside a big cage. They would even, like, Irish whip each other into the fences. And, it just looked a little odd to me. But it just seemed like a lot of build-up for a regular cage match is all.
Yeah. I would almost bet that they probably tried to get John McCarthy to officiate this, because this is right when Brawl for All was starting.
Yeah.
And John McCarthy was contacted to officiate Brawl for All.
Right. And I don't imagine, like, the UFC would have had much
the UFC,
it, right?
They probably would have thought, hey, this is – they were – this 98, they were fucking dying. Yeah. Like, it was the dark days of the UFC. So the last thing they were worried about was the WWE infringing on any of their intellectual property. And fuck saying the words UFC on a pay-per-view being seen by 700,000 people. I'm sure they had no issue with it at all. In fact, at this point, I would say Ken Shamrock was probably the best promotion for the UFC during this time period, perhaps, being in the WWF.
Nope.
Michael Cole is in the back with Steve Austin, stating that he doesn't trust anyone, including The Undertaker, but respects him, but will cheap shot his way to victory if he has to keep this title. Okay. Noble babyface. Just straight up. I'll fuck with whatever rules I've got to win. And then we went to the no-holds-barred handicap match. Mankind defending the tag titles by himself against the New Age Outlaws. And the Outlaws brought out a dumpster wearing their South Park t-shirts. And the match began with cookie tray shots and a light ECW chant from the crowd. Cookie trays. Billy Gunn and Mankind started, like, attacking each other with chair shots, just hitting the chairs, not each other. And then the New Age Outlaws got the advantage with tray shots to the head of Mick Foley. And this is where this match just kind of went into this weird area for me.
Well, I was just kind of confused about who the babyface was.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This was like, first of all, you have Foley coming off that Hell in a Cell match where it was like, people like just had a hard time hating this guy at this point. So it was like the turn was inevitable. And here he is, 2-on-1 against these absolute prick babyfaces. Like, just pricks here. Like, they didn't even, like, they were just so dislikable in this match and in the post-match.
Mm-hmm.
And watching this, I hate watching these matches because you see how Mick Foley gets around today, and then you watch this stuff that a large part of it is the cause of why he is the condition he is now.
I know what you're saying. And what really gets to me, too, is just how forgettable a lot of these things were.
Exactly. It's spots that no one remembers from his career and stuff that was just incredibly dangerous and punishing at the time. There was this one spot where they are on the floor and they grab Mick and whip him into the dumpster with the back of his head, the most dangerous part of your head to make contact with, slams into the dumpster, just slams into it. I cringed watching this. And it was just like a spot for him just to lie down on the ground for a few minutes and then get back up and gets in, reverses a hip toss in the ring, putting Billy Gunn through a table in the corner. Then the Outlaws hit a neck breaker. They set up two chairs in the ring. The crowd is chanting for Foley as they powerbomb him through both chairs. He kicks out, and they even went to play the Outlaws' music here after this near fall, thinking it was over. And the crowd starts chanting, "You fucked up," at the production team. And then they hit a spike pile driver to Foley and pin him at 5:17. Road Dogg does his catchphrase, announcing them as the new champions. And Billy Gunn gets on top of Mankind and yells at him, saying, "Don't you ever, ever think you can beat us on your own. And we're going to put you in the garbage where you belong." What a babyface. Yeah. And believe me, he was a full 100% babyface at this point.
It was very confusing.
And Ross is like clearly seeing how this is coming across and says, "I'm not blaming the Outlaws. They were dealt this hand." And he's trying to put all the heat on Vince McMahon for just wanting to put Mankind in dangerous situations. But they toss Mankind into the dumpster, and then Kane emerges from the dumpster with a sledgehammer, and we are led to believe that he drops this right onto Foley. I can only pray that this was there was no contact here. But no,
of course.
Listen, there are stupid stunts that we have seen in wrestling before.
You think Foley would have said, "No, really hit me with it," so that the thud is...
Listen, that sounds stupid, but it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I don't know.
Remember Bill Goldberg? I don't want the glass gimmicked on the limo. I'm going to punch my arm through and nearly shredded his tendon doing so.
Yeah.
Like, there are people that just did not think about stuff.
Sure.
Anyway, let's assume that there was no contact made here. New Age Outlaws win the tag titles. I hated this match, personally. I thought the whole dynamic was fucked,
yeah,
and just, I don't enjoy these kinds of matches. I'm sure some people do, but I just don't.
I mean, but even as far as a hardcore match goes, this wasn't even that anything. Like, this was just, it felt like a very little flow, and you're right, the dynamic between the handicapped babyface and then the other two babyfaces was just very strange. In the end, I don't know. I don't remember much from it.
Then they showed the video for the Rock Triple H feud that had been going on all summer, featuring the DX impersonating the Nation on TV, very famous segment. The Rock then attacking Hunter, leading to Brown winning the European title from them. They had a time limit draw at the July pay-per-view entitled Fully Loaded,
yeah,
which was the poster. I brought this up with Court Bauer a few weeks ago. Features Triple H on the poster with the turnbuckle emerging between his legs. Titled Fully Loaded.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nothing suggestive about that.
Nope. And then they had a street fight on Raw, which ends up leading to the ladder match, and a big promo from Hunter telling Rocky that in New York, you're going to be my bitch.
Ooh.
Yeah, there's a promise.
Bitch.
And then we got the return of the Chris Warren Band, who did one of the worst renditions of America the Beautiful at WrestleMania that year, and following the negative criticism, they brought him back for an encore here at SummerSlam.
Well, this time at least it was a song they knew.
Yeah, they did the DX theme.
Jim Johnston was out here playing guitar.
Oh, was he?
Yep.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Well, you could tell because he was like the oldest member of the band.
the bald guy with glasses?
Yeah, just like the kind of regular looking dude with a guitar.
He's one of my few people that is on my list of people I'd love to interview.
Yeah.
He'd be such a... outside of Beyond the Mat, have you ever heard that guy doing an interview?
You're right. And, you know, you talk about ideas for documentaries. There's a documentary waiting to happen. Just talk about the history of, you know, all the iconic wrrestling songs. Like, because, I mean, these songs, they are wrestling songs, but they're also songs of, our youth, you know? Like, a lot of people, they just hear that Million Dollar Man song. I don't know if he did that one or not, but... anyway, yeah. Just the whole DVD about entrance music, I think, would be cool.
Yeah. I don't think he's with the company anymore.
Is that right?
I think he had left.
Are you sure? Because he's still attributed to a lot of the current songs,
I could be wrong. He might
that Kesha song you thought Caitlyn.
Yeah, you're right.
He's still
I think he might have left at some point, and maybe he's back or something. I don't know. But that guy, talk about like an unsung MVP of that company. It's Jim Johnston.
Well, I will say this DX band playing this DX theme song.
Not the MVPs of the show?
No, I thought it sounded terrible.
I loved watching Hunter rock out to his own theme music, and like he's fucking like his hair's all flying. He's like, oh, he looked like such a dork here.
Yeah,
with his fucking purple spandex tights.
He really did.
Yeah. He went through some weird images.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't think he really had a good look until he grew out his beard, his goatee,
right,
and he switched to the trunks. That's when I think, but before that he looked pretty, I don't know, just like a big doofus.
He used to wear, like, his spandex run, he would have, like, just the most out there, like, red, purple, like, he'd just have, like, outrageous, like, colored spandex.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Hunter, and then as soon as the song ends, fucking destroy all the equipment.
It was lame.
Oh, it's like, this is like the cliche most, of like what a rock band does.
Oh, yeah, we're such rock and rollers.
Oh, it's like, I was waiting for them to get onto the mic and tell the girls what hotel they're staying at. Like,
yeah.
It's like every cliche imaginable. And then The Rock comes out. Rock was just so much cooler here than Triple H, I thought. It was like, here's the guy I would want to cheer for if I was a fan. So we had China in Triple H's corner and Mark Henry in the corner of The Rock to even things out. And the match starts with Rock clearly mouthing the word motherfucker and fuck you to Hunter to start the match.
That didn't get edited on the DVD?
Nope, that was there.
Yeah.
Then they fight in the aisle. Hunter gets Irish whipped into the ladder against the ring, and they pretty much had to start attacking the knee right away because, I mean, why not? It's like the guy's working hurt. You might as well play to your advantage, and that's what he did, attacking the knee of Hunter. And Rock would attack with the ladder, using the chair on the ladder. And you could see kind of early on into the match, you could see this New York crowd was certainly getting behind Rock. Like, you could sense just where his popularity was here, and he seemed to be the breakout star of this match, even in losing, I thought.
Yeah, I would say so.
The match continued here. Some great stuff here. They catapulted Hunter into the ladder against the barricade on the floor. Hunter did some really great selling in this match, I thought. And Rock was just really, really solid as well here as like the heel foil. At one point, they had Henry toss a second ladder into the ring. And he's holding Hunter as China comes and attacks Mark Henry. Hunter recovered. He baseball slid the ladder into Rock after knocking him to the floor off the ladder. There was a DDT to Hunter by The Rock, with both just selling, and the crowd really getting into things as they were selling here and giving them a chance to let the crowd breathe during a lot of these big spots. And then there was Hunter got slammed onto the ladder as Rock hit the people's elbow, and the crowd just loved this. They start chanting Rocky after that spot. Then a Rock bottom as Hunter jumps off the ladder into the Rock's arms and gets hit with it. Hunter then yanks Rock down and hits a pedigree, and the crowd pops for that. But then Mark Henry tosses powder into the face of Hunter. Both are climbing up with Hunter blinded, and with the referee distracted, China runs in and low blows the Rock, who falls down. Hunter continues to climb, grabs the title, and wins the match. This was just one of the best Rock and Hunter matches, and this was a breakout match for both performers. But I think the big takeaway at the time was, you know, Hunter's like got a ton of potential, but like Rock is like main event level. I think that's what a lot of people felt at this point. Like, this guy was just, and he was like 26 at this point. Pretty nuts.
That is amazing. And it was just really cool to just see the crowd reactions build as the match progressed.
This was like a star-making performance for both in this match, and just a great, great match. I think this match kind of gets overshadowed when it comes to ladder matches. It was one. It wasn't like heavy stunts and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, working around the ladder, but told a really good story. Rock even bleeding at one point during this.
Mm-hmm.
Did you watch the home video exclusive?
No, I didn't.
You skipped through it?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, Rock just walked to the back and then cut a promo into the camera.
Yeah.
But as they're walking into they just follow him as he walks to his locker room, and he's saying nothing, and everyone in the back is freaking the fuck out. They're like, where's Taker? Where is Taker? Like, they couldn't find him or something for the next match. So that was the best part of that. And he cuts his promo into the camera, and he ends it, talk about a tie-in to today, saying, just remember, Hunter, payback is a bitch.
Ooh.
what's old is new again.
Yeah.
The Undertaker comes out for the main event. They apparently found him, and Jim Ross is putting him over huge, stating that he has beaten Hulk Hogan and Psycho Sid for the titles in the past. And Austin got, like, this customized entrance where they had this sheet of glass with, like, the Austin mascot, I guess it was. And the glass breaks.
The skull.
Yeah, the skull wearing clothing.
Yes.
Yeah, a clothed skeleton. Great ideas. At least he didn't have, like, a mascot or something come out with him.
What would his mascot be?
Stone Bone Steve. You're putting me on the spot here. Ross just put over Austin's entrance huge. He tells Lawler, I defy you to name any other champion that's gotten a reaction like that in this building. I challenge you. And Jerry's just conceding, like, hey, I'm sure, man. The building is shaking, as Ross said. Mm-hmm. So a big main event feel, I thought, that Ross created for this match. And this was the big draw on the show. And they brawl at the start. And Austin starts attacking the arm with, like, a hammer lock. They're trying to make a very technical version of Steve Austin. And then there's a spot early on, and Austin has talked about this spot in some DVD releases, but Undertaker bends over as he Irish whips Austin. Austin comes off the ropes, and Undertaker just pops his head up and blasts Austin in his chin. And Austin was legitimately knocked silly here. And this is like 3 minutes into the match. And you can see Earl Hebner trying to talk to Austin. And I don't know how long it lasted, but you could tell Austin was kind of knocked for a loop here.
I was wondering if that was legit, because the announcers made mention of it as well.
Yeah, they made mention to it. And Austin has said it in future interviews just about the spot. And you can see it in slow motion where just right on the chin. Like, he was probably, like, out here.
Wow.
Momentarily.
That's amazing.
And anyway, Austin is working over the left knee of Taker. At one point, Kane comes down to the ring, playing off the storyline if he's working with Taker. And Taker sends him to the back and ends up choke-slamming Austin from the outside of the apron into the ring. They brawl through the crowd. Austin takes a back body drop on the cement. They come back into the ring, and Taker avoids a stunner as the crowd gets excited at the chance of seeing the stunner. And Austin gets driven back first into the post on the floor. Then Taker sets up Austin onto the announce desk. Undertaker climbs up to the top. And if you wonder why this man has had to have surgery on his hip, this is probably one of the reasons why. He dives off the top rope to the announce table on the floor with a guillotine leg drop where the table does not break, and he slides to the floor. Yeah. This looked ungodly painful.
Oh, man.
Holy shit. Like,
the monitor was still on the table as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, like, you know, it's one thing for, I guess even, like, you know, a guy the size of Shane McMahon to do it, but it's another for somebody the size of Undertaker to do this.
Shane would also do, like, elbow drops, which, right, it's not putting all of the emphasis on, like, your fucking tailbone.
Yeah.
To absorb this.
It's still brutal no matter what, but, you know, hey, kudos for this guy to try something like this.
If you're going to do it, it's a big show, and it's not like this is Fandango, who is doing this, like, every week on TV, that leg drop off the top, which, yeah, I fear for that man.
Sure.
Seeing Hulk Hogan right now from doing that leg drop from, like, 2 feet in the air every night.
I think Fandango is going to have to change his move.
I don't know why he hasn't already.
Yeah.
Crazy. They had a double clothesline spot. Austin comes back with the Thez press, and then Taker hits a choke slam, goes for the tombstone, which Austin blocks, and then Austin gets dropped on the top rope, and Undertaker goes for the old school. School was just regularly in session here in 98. But Austin hits a low blow as Taker comes off the top rope and out of nowhere hits the stunner from this and pins Taker clean after about 20 minutes. And then afterwards, Taker grabs the title, hands it to Austin, doing the mutual respect. And then Taker and Kane are seen standing together in the aisle. And then they walk to the back as Austin celebrates in the ring for the show to go off the air. And continuing with the story of our Taker and Kane working together and ultimately would be as they would go into the fall.
Okay. I really liked the match. I thought it was really good. And I think I was just a little surprised at how fast these two were working throughout the entire thing. I guess maybe I'm used to seeing Austin and Taker maybe working a little slower, at least to start. But
right.
Here, they're working very fast throughout the entire thing. And I thought Jim Ross was fantastic as well.
Yeah, he was really great here. And this was even a year after Austin's like major neck problem and everything like that. So, I mean, he worked in a very... very fast style, very physical style at the time, but the last two matches I thought really stood out on this show. Mm-hmm. There were some moments earlier in the show, like good and bad. I wouldn't call this a thumbs up pay per view. Put it like in the middle. I give the show 6.5 out of 10. Ladder match certainly match of the night.
Yeah, I give it a 7.
All right. We have a bunch of feedback for this show, so we should dive into it right now. And we start off with first bit of feedback here. I loved this show as a kid, probably because of the great DVD cover. Yeah, they had some awesome artwork here where, like, Austin and Taker, they're, like, battling in New York City with one having, like, a building and the other having, like, the Statue of Liberty. So some cool artwork they had here. And tagline of Highway to Hell. I love this time in wrestling, especially with the amount of talent. Hell, you had Legion of Doom, Vader, and Goldust on the undercard on Sunday Night Heat. I always enjoyed The Rock and Triple H's mid-card feud with The Nation and DX rather than their main event feuds. Very close call with Earl Hebner being in the ring, almost getting blasted with The Undertaker's pyro. I love the story going into the main event with McMahon trying to prove the conspiracy of the Undertaker and Kane working together, and one of my fondly remembered scenes where we thought Kane had won the number one contenders match on Raw, only for him to take the mask off, revealing that it was The Undertaker. This show gets an 8 out of 10.
Craig here says, I was really very surprised by the Valvina Steel Brown match, probably my match of the show outside of the standout ladder match. JR and King were possibly at their peak here, chemistry-wise, finishing off each other's sentences, and well, JR is just awesome in 1998. Jeff Jarrett didn't really get much of a haircut, did he? 7 out of 10, couple of undercard matches weren't great. The intergender tag match was saved by Edge, and I don't like WWF's version of cage fighting. That match would have been so much better if they had the big roped ring to use.
We go to Andrew McDonald, who writes, this was one of my favorite WWE shows of the time. My aunt recorded a number of pay-per-views for me, and this was on a VHS with other shows from the 97-98 period. I've been listening to a number of old WCW reveal-ways, and this is a nice contrast to WCW at the time, with a card stacked with great young talent. The ladder match in particular, I remember, as being a huge launching point for The Rock and Triple H. It's amazing that nowadays the mid-card champions are constantly losing, and on the card, the European title was contested in a great match, and the IC title was contested between two future megastars. Rock, at this point, had been the IC champion since Austin pretty much gave it to him in December, and while that didn't help the title at the time, being around The Rock's waist when he became the leader, no, excuse me, the ruler of the nation, certainly helped cement the title's importance. One match I really enjoyed as great comedy was Kai and Tai against the Oddities. It wasn't technically very good, but I thought it was pretty fun. One thing that did bother me at the time was Jeff Jarrett not really losing all his hair. Double J had been shaving people's heads building up this match, but when it came time for him to lose his hair, the babyfaces just gave up and let him get a crew cut instead. How humiliating. I don't have mid-90s style wrestling hair anymore. Great show, though. 8 out of 10.
From Skull Captain. Hola, la Canadienne. SummerSlam 98 was an interesting card. I remember the show fondly from watching it at the time, but I did not enjoy this reviewing of the event 15 years later. The opening match was good and got the crowd going and then ended poorly. Way's favorites, Kai and Tai, then proved that Vinnie Mac has no idea about any wrestling outside of his own company. The tag match was nothing at all. I cannot even remember Kane and Mankind being a team. And the less said about Sable's performance on the mic and in the ring, the better. Double J and X-Pac was solid mid-card fare, and props to Jarrett for letting X-Pac near him with scissors. It was really great to watch Owen Hart again. I always thought he was a better all-around performer than Brett, but he seems surplus to requirements here, simply used as a prelim for Shamrock and Severn to start their feud, which would fizzle quickly after. I seem to remember the Rock Triple H feud to be very hot at the time, slightly uncomfortable watching the blackface DX promo as the Nation of Domination, though. But I did feel this ladder match was a bit low on action, even if it was high on crowd reaction. Some say it was better than Shawn Razor at WrestleMania 10, but I disagree. I have to say that the main event was also a bit flat for me. It offered great brawling from both guys, but seemed to be without real passion from either worker. Maybe I just remembered a swerve from this event, which never happened. All in all, slightly disappointing event despite a hot MSG crowd.
All right, next up we go to Trent from Texas. This undoubtedly was the greatest and most exciting time in history to be a wrestling fan. Well, that's quite the statement. There were so many factors in this time period that made it so amazing, but one often gets overlooked, that being the dramatic increase in the amount of complete and utter skanks throughout the crowds. I swear to God, it went up by at least 1,000% within a year of this show. It seemed like at every Raw and pay-per-view, there were tons of shady-looking girls with tongue rings willing to flash their tits at the drop of a dime. This show was the culmination of this trend because there were this is really not the nicest feedback here, Trent. I mean, you're doing a lot of assumptions here. Anyway, I'm gonna skip this because this really has nothing to do with the event, but he gives it a 9 out of 10.
Blaine Vandergren, this was a so-so pay-per-view for me. Nothing on the show was terrible in my opinion, but at the same time, nothing really blew me away. It seemed like there were a lot of technical issues though, and perhaps the one that stands out the most was when you could hear one of the producers yell at Earl Hebner to get out of the ring before the pyro went off during the Undertaker's entrance. For two rookies at the time, Venus and D'Lo had a really good match that was ruined by a bad finish. I found it kind of odd that the Insane Clown Posse got to perform on the show, but Method Man had to sit up in the nosebleed section and kind of got snubbed by the announcers as he was only mentioned in passing. I say that because I remember the Wu-Tang Clan being very big at the time. The Lion's Den match was good, but everything else, like the camera angles and entrances, were poor quality. The ladder match was match of the night, as there were a lot of neat spots and false finishes with two guys that aren't really high flyers, and the main event was good as well, and I was impressed that they put Austin over Cleanish, since beating Taker at the time was kind of a big deal, and actually it still is.
No, oh, it was a big show. He won a clean finish, I would say. Yeah. How big were Wu-Tang in 98?
That was probably like the peak of their popularity. I mean, that was when their second album came out. So
when did ODB die?
Oh, man. I don't know, 2000, maybe 2 or 3? I don't know specifically.
And you were a fan at this time?
Yeah, relatively, you know.
November 2004.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. But, you know, maybe just because he was one member versus, you know, you got to get all nine.
How cool would that have been if they were all in a row together?
Yeah, in the back.
Yeah, in the back. Okay, to the next one here. The WWE was incredibly exciting at this time, although it would really explode over the next couple of years. In 98, you could sense it, and you felt you were in on the ground floor. It's like owning the first couple of singles by a great band and knowing the album is going to be huge. As for the matches, so cool to see a young Edge. Man, was he thin, like a pipe cleaner. The gimmicks were all nuts, and it really did feel like nothing you'd ever seen from the WWE before. I enjoyed this for what it is, and I think it stands up as an interesting times piece, though you probably wouldn't show it to people as an example of great technical wrestling. I give it 6 D'Lo Brown head bobs out of 10.
Like a pipe cleaner.
A pipe cleaner. He was a very skinny individual.
Alan Gaynor. This was a very entertaining show. My two personal favorite matches were the 8-man tag and the main event. The 8-man was just an example of how over everyone was at the time. I guess this match would be the equivalent of 3MB versus Natalya, the Great Khali, and Hornswoggle. But if that match happens, I don't think I'll look back at it fondly 15 years later. As for the main event, it was perhaps the best-built main event at SummerSlam history. Although Taker and Austin tangled several times before, and would battle a few more times after, they really made this one feel special. Great show overall, loaded not only with great wrestlers, but also three of the greatest MMA stars of all time, Ken Shamrock, Dan Severn, and Giant Silva.
Johnny Jackson. Hello, ladies. Love that D'Lo was hailing from Helsinki because of his European title reign. D'Lo's chest protector brought back some fond memories, and still to this day, every time I wear a gillet? What does that mean? G-I-L-E-T.
I'm not sure.
I describe it as my D'Lo chest protector. Pretty good match between Val and D'Lo as well. Also nice to see Kurgan dancing, even though the match was really poor. Fink wearing a DX shirt was priceless, almost as JR calling the match between Double J and X-Pac a real dandy. My God, Mick Foley is great at promos and worked so well with Vince at the time. Always thought the Lion's Den matches were pretty dumb, and after watching this one, I still do. Really enjoyed the 2-on-1 match with Mankind and the New Age Outlaws. Probably a key moment in turning Mankind face. Ladder match was not the best, but fun to see the evolution of The Rock and Hunter. I always think Austin and The Undertaker's rivalry is overbooked, even though they always had really great matches, and this was one of them, and I enjoyed it greatly. 7 chest protectors out of 10.
A gillet is a sleeveless jacket resembling a waistcoat or blouse.
Is it like our jackets we just got on the weekend? Our Kojiko jackets?
No, those are vests.
No, it's too bad.
I don't think they're Kojiko gillets.
That would be awesome if there were, though.
Yeah. Okay, we go next to Daniel, who says, this SummerSlam, in my opinion, ranks in the top three of best SummerSlams. The build in the summer of 98 was brilliant, with Austin, Taker, Kane, and Mankind, and remembering as a kid how hot the WWF was at the time. Austin and Taker was a good match. I love the top rope leg drop to the table by Taker, and I don't know if you guys saw it, but Austin has told quite a few times on the DVD and book that there's a spot where, yes, we went through that. The ladder match was a show stealer, and even though Triple H won the match, I would say The Rock became a bigger star as he was getting cheered. And the two-on-one hardcore match was a fun brawl. However, JR's call when Kane comes out from the dumpster was awesome, and JR throughout the night was just brilliant. Him and King were gold. I enjoyed the Lion's Den match. I thought Owen and Shamrock worked well with each other. Opener was fine to start the show. The hair match was all right, and the mixed tag was what it was.
Okay, next up here. I haven't seen this pay-per-view since it originally aired, but I still remember the promotional poster for it. Cartoon Austin and Taker wielding buildings in a giant battle. It all started off with the coveted chest protector that everyone remembers fondly. On a side note, I was 13 when this event happened. I got 99% of the euphemisms in Val Venus' entrance video, and upon watching it all these years later, I felt pretty stupid that the one image 13-year-old me didn't get was a helmeted Val Venus rising from a bush. I would say that fact slapped modern-day me in the face, but that would be a poor choice of words. The match was fine, but it made me realize how flimsy that supposed loaded chest protector really looked. But who cares? It's still amazing. The rest of the undercard was good, but I'm sure it was better with my 1998 eyes. Hair versus hair was very enjoyable, but they should have invested in clippers that could actually cut. Mixed tag was fine for what it was, but I preferred the one at Capital Carnage that year for two large, round, bare, obvious reasons. Oh, yes. JR reminded me that Sable was the one that gave the oddities personality. I'm still amazed that ICP basically did their entire WWF run for free, according to them, on an Art of Wrestling show. Wacky. The crowd did seem to enjoy moving their hands about. I really enjoyed the Lion's Den match with some tweaks that could still work today. Maybe the sloped walls did it for me. I did chuckle when they cut back to the arena and they were wheeling away those ringside TVs. I miss those days. And the main and semi-main were the reason this pay-per-view was good. JR was phenomenal during these matches, and it never once seemed like he was faking it. This was during a time when the IC title still meant something and was still a stepping stone for bigger things, and The Rock and Hunter delivered. WWF title match had a great build, and the emotion of JR and Lawler put this match over huge. I hate those tables, though. They rarely cooperate. Great. And he gives us a 7 out of 10.
Thick Tough Guy says, you guys got to stop reviewing shows that I keep thinking about. Anyway, awesome show. Rock versus Triple H ladder match was the tallywhacker of matches. These men killed each other, literally. Austin and Taker was the good lick mates, and be merry.
Okay, next one comes from Shai in Israel, who has a screen capture of the Golga sign we mentioned earlier. It says, poor John Tenta. Just when you thought he couldn't get a worse character than being a human talking shark, they put him in a gold mask and make him cherish his Cartman doll and dance around with freaks. Now, when I think of SummerSlam 98, the first image that comes to mind is Taker's perfect leg drop on the announce table. This and the illustrated promos of Taker and Austin tearing down New York City. WWE never had the reputation of being in fashion when it comes to music picks, but boy, did they nail it in 98. They picked a song that was released 20 years earlier. Bon Scott, AC/DC's original singer. Yes, they had two. Unlike to what John said in the past, had passed away in 79. I was hoping to get pumped up with this classic track, but unfortunately the home video version that had a generic theme instead chopped out the main event video. After watching the event, what you notice the most of this era compared to recent years is that any rookie that was brought up was ready for TV. Edge, Christian, Val Venus, D'Lo, the Hardys. Another thing I noticed that was done different was the commentators actually telling us how old the talent is. Won't happen today because all major talent is in their late 30s, early 40s. When people ask when was the last time the IC title was relevant, this was it. And he gives us a 9 out of 10.
We go to Shane Silver, who perhaps the most obscene feedback we've had. He says, I'm currently in the process of packing up my gear to head off for a 5-day cock rock festival in the Moro.
What?
Cock rock.
What does that mean?
I don't know. Hence the following short review. My brain is saying, pack, you fool. But F that. This is SummerSlam 98. It deserves my goddamn time. F. Everything in this event is pure gold, even the oddities. F that, especially the oddities. Kurgan is the man. Awesome ladder match which did something really weird. It was actually an effing ladder match. You know, two guys trying to grab a prestigious title and doing everything in their power to keep the opponent down. Storytelling, bitches. All those other convoluted ladder
storytelling, bitches.
We're really trying hard to get a round of applause here. Moments can effing do one. That was greatness. And China gave someone a low blow. Tentacular stuff. Undertaker again shows his man skills with a big ass leg drop to F my broken ass neck Steve Austin onto the goddamn announce table. Less is more, folks, but why is this? That's why the spot is so effing epic. What match was the standard Austin warfare, but what more do you effing want? Double moonsaults? F that. Kick, wham, stunner. What else? Oh yeah, Kane murdered a man. Of course, why the F not? Fan effing Tasia. Everything else was shit hot, even if it was dumb. How can a match called effing Lion's Den match not be the best thing since slice effing bread? Good bread at that, none of the cheap loaf bollocks. Brilliant show, and I'm going to break my back carrying all these bags of alcohol. Manning, the F up.
Wow, what a piece of feedback to end us off this week.
How poetic.
Well, thank you, everybody, for your feedback to SummerSlam 98. An interesting show to go back and check out, and we'll probably get to some more SummerSlam shows later on, as we happen to be in the season of summer coming up, Way.
Yeah.
But next week, we're going to kind of stay on this exact same theme, Way, because, you know, summer is associated with many things. What comes to mind when you think of summer?
Japanese wrestling.
Well, yes.
Japanese women's wrestling.
Well, think of the absolute worst summer camp you've ever attended, and then multiply it by a million, and you would probably have a Japanese dojo for these women wrestlers that want to break into the industry. And next week, we are going to go back to reviewing a documentary, because this is a documentary I've actually never seen and have just always wanted to watch. So me and Wei have a lot of downtime this week in Winnipeg, so I thought, what is something that I wouldn't mind sticking around and watching in my hotel room later this week? So we are going to review the 2001 documentary Gaia Girls, which focuses on a number of women breaking into the business, and this is a far cry from Tough Enough.
Yeah, I'll bet.
There's no roller skates and going to restaurants and singing, and there's no million-dollar houses to stay in.
But it'll probably act as a good precursor to Total Divas.
I think that is the better parallel.
Yeah.
We should have saved this for week one of Total Divas and reviewed both together.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a look at that. This documentary is also available for free on YouTube. It's a very hard-to-find documentary anywhere else. So we will post the documentary and give it an open mind. You might not be familiar with all of these names, but I think that's kind of secondary to just the story of this this documentary. It in fact screened, I believe, up here in Toronto like a decade ago at like a hot dogs festival and stuff like that. So we will take a look at that on Review Away next week, and that will be a fun documentary, I think. Why?
I look forward to it.
So what a contrast. We're going to go from Kai and Tai to a very different portrayal of Japanese wrestlers next week.
Yeah. Who made it? Like, who made this documentary?
You know what? I will...
It's in English, right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
It's... It's been out for... Oh, 2000 it came in. So it was done by Kim Longanoto and Jano Williams.
Okay.
And it features Chigusa Nageo, who at one time was like the biggest female star in the world. So there you go. Came out in October of 2000 and aired on the BBC. So I imagine, yes, it is in English.
We should review some of the gayest stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we could take a look at some of it.
At some point.
Yeah. Well, this is a good starting off point. So.
Yeah. Yeah, good introduction.
All right, so we'll take a look at that documentary next week. In the meantime, as we said off the top, me and Wei are here in Winnipeg all week long for UFC 161 Fight Week. We were at the open workouts earlier today. More interviews coming later on this week, which will be airing on Fight Network as well. All of our stuff will be up at youtube.com/fightnetworkfc. Fight Network. So that's your easiest way to grab all of the interviews we're doing here in Winnipeg, doing a lot of shows this week, including the live weigh-ins, which will be taking place Friday evening, as well as a post show that'll be airing on the network immediately after the UFC 161 card, which is headlined by Dan Henderson and Rashad Evans. Three-round main event. It is one of the fights on the main card that has stayed together throughout this entire lead-up to UFC 161. And then we will be back later on this week. If we can't see Impact, maybe we can squeeze in a show at least later this week. I don't know what the... I haven't even checked my TV yet to know if we get Spike TV in our hotel.
I kind of doubt it but you know, maybe not, because we're at Shaw, we're not Rogers.
So. Yeah, it's mainly, we do have a place to go watch Impact. It's more just what our schedule is, because we are being asked to do 10 million things here in Winnipeg. So it's just more or less trying to find time to watch some of these wrestling shows. So a little difficult at times. Plus, the MMA report will be coming out on Thursday, featuring lots of comments from various fighters on the card coming up on Saturday night, along with my picks for the show, and then a show this week tentatively with Court Bauer as well. So lots of stuff coming up. And on Thursday, the full 50-minute interview with George the Animal Steel will be up. I've gotten a ton of comments from people who really enjoyed the portion of the interview we aired on Sunday night with George chatting about his time as a road agent in the WWE and lots of other stuff. So a full-length interview with Dan Lavransky will be coming up on Thursday. So in the meantime, you can follow Way at Way0937, at I Am John Pollock, and, of course, liveaudiowrestling.com. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher app, all that great stuff. And as we get on out of here, Way... do you have something that really can sum up today's show? Maybe something from Method Man.
Yeah, I was trying to look and see what there was, but he had just released an album, actually, in 98. And so let's go out with the first single from that album. This is from Tikal 2000, Judgment Day.
Oh, there you go. One of the few Method Man songs I am familiar with.
Oh,
wow.
There
you go. White Pollock. That's offensive.
You said that, not me.
As I walk in the shadow of death, 16 men on a dead man's chest. Your host is Steve with the H.O.T. And I guess you get splashed with the tech. Nobody go till the guards say so. You got a second to mow, you run for the devil. Before I blow back off the map contact, you take no stack, cause you down like that. Line from top rock to launcher, yes. Mr. Map, hold the foremost step. Cats step wrong, song's too long. Get swung on, can't we all get along? See my pinky, see my thumb. See that kid with the pawn shotgun. Bust your guns, leave your whole shit numb. Now what's this, smell like fish? Mr. Big Mouth, Gappy Trap. You need a good shot, style no gap. Shallin' struck through the shallin' shrunk. Bump, bump, bump on the shallin' drum. Kick his duck there, step in the square. Kids ain't playing over here. Player, only one way, and that's my way. Grim Reaper calling, Judgment Day. Let the countdown begin. I was born in the nine, in with the head of the snake. Behold, I'm a game, sick, and the love of the rich. Only strong will survive, but we live on the score. 3+6 to 3, 2 for the black and the blue, 1 for the sun. Step into millennium. The name of this one is Judgment Day. When war together can't come out and play. Don't blame me, blame society. Time to chemistry for a live MC. Hands in the air like you just don't care. You're walking in shit. There's a party over here. Key 2000. Keep bouncing. T-minus 30 seconds of counting. New York climbing. Still wilding. Shallin. At the full moon howling. Get till it's gone. Killer be killed. Only time will reveal like the words on the song. Slow, but I feel for my crew what's dead. Niggas still got to pay my bill. Be a low pack, slingshot flow. Let the seed, let the garden grow. Nick that round where the sun don't shine. Don't hit your heart like a valentine. This one chill from the crypt that's sick. Suck bad, fight fast as shit. UFC fighting championships. G.I. Joe's with the kung fu grip. Now you don't dare step in the square. Kids ain't playing overhead. Player, play one way, and that's my way. Grim Reaper calling, Judgment Day. Come on, I said come on. Let the countdown begin. I was born in the mind. Can't take the head of the snake. Behold, I'm again. Ain't no love for the rich. Only strong will survive. Strong cause we live by the sword. 3+6 to 3. 2 for the black and the blue. 1 for the sun. Stepping from a living gun. As I walk in the shadow of death. 16 men on a deck and check. Your hope is deep at the H.O.T. And I guess you get splashed with the tech. Nobody go to the guard say so. You got a second to move to run for the dough. Before I go back off the map.